Hello, I'm Saga Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we flip to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we interview one of the contributors about their chosen topic. So it's all about the craft of game narrative and game writing. This week, we have Ian Thomas with us. Hello, Ian.
Hello. Hope things are going well.
Things are going well. We're very happy to have you here. Could you please introduce yourself to our listeners? Tell us a bit about you, maybe how you've sort of arrived into this career and where you are now.
Sure. So, I'm Ian Thomas. I work at the Chinese Room as a narrative director. And that's a really broad role description, as with anything in games writing. But mostly I'm pulling together strands of story in different ways and trying to help the rest of the team all collaborate on that story together and all share a vision for what that story is and how it's delivered and how it fundamentally makes the player feel, which is really what I see as my main aim. In terms of how I got there, like almost every other games writer, I took a really weird route. I started off working for a cartoon studio, the studio that made Super Ted, if anybody's old enough to remember that. Remember Super Ted? So that was great.
That's great.
Well, that was old. It was all paper animation, so it was all sketched paper animation. There were computers, and there were the computers involved. And I was hired as part of a team to make edutainment at the time, proper, you know, kiddie cartoon software. But we were able to go to animators and say, "Can you give me an animation for this, please?" And they would go away and they drew it on thin onion skin paper, and then we'd have to scan it in Photoshop and color it ourselves and all the rest of it. And we had background artists who'd use airbrushes to do it. And it was stunning. Anyway, I did that for a while. I ended up leading design and code for a lot of stuff. They're not the educational side of it. Then I went off and did interactive TV for years. And in the old days of Sky, Red Button, interactive TV, we did wonderful things like interactive bingo and stuff like that. It was quite groundbreaking, but fundamentally it was interactive bingo. But there was some really interesting full cycle. The player has logged in and the presenter gets to talk straight to the player because they can see them log in. So there's some really interesting stuff happening there.
Yeah, very cool.
And I ended up in charge of the tech of that, mostly because our boss didn't buy the manuals of the tech and we had to work it out and re-engineer it from first principles. And somehow that meant that I ended up in charge of tech. And so I ran tech companies for a while. I went back to edutainment for a while. And then one day I just went, I've had enough of this, and applied to Traveller's Tales to do Lego. I ended up working on the Lego games for a bit. But that was mostly tech and systems and programming, and I've been a programmer for a very long time. But in parallel to that, I was writing screenplays and things. My brother's a director, and in the early days, we ended up writing films together and making them physically, making them, blowing things up, that sort of thing, which was always good. And then I have for many, many years written and run LARP events, so anything from 10 people to 4,500. Which is probably the crucible, that and tabletop role-playing, I guess, but probably the crucible in which I had to learn a lot about structuring things non-linearly, thinking about experiences particularly. But also, when you're doing it at, I guess, what I'd call a high level, you're doing things like producing big effects with an art department, a stunt team, audio, all of that kind of thing. And if the players go the wrong way and they don't see that thing, or that thing doesn't happen, then that's a lot of budget that you've blown. So how do you make the players think that they were doing that thing? And how does it all seamlessly feel like it kind of makes sense? So an awful lot of what we were doing is hiding, tricking, stage magic type effects to try and persuade people to feel a certain way so that they felt that they had choices when perhaps they didn't have choices, which is way easier with that than it is with something like computer games, because in computer games you play the thing twice and see that it wasn't a choice after all. But on one big immersive event, it only ever happens once, and they never get to know what you were doing behind the curtain. So that's the fundamental background. And off the back of that stuff, and the fact I was spending more than 8 hours a day writing interactive things, and then the other 8 hours coding, and then maybe sometimes sleeping, it had to come to a crunch at some point, and I just went, right, that's it. I've had enough of coding. We're going to go and do writing full time, and that was a bunch of years ago, and seems to have worked.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, frankly, I feel like I'm lowering the tone of the podcast just asking our de facto second question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because, like, one attempts to have some kind of brand management going on in the face of, like, someone who appears to have done every single kind of interactive narrative in existence. Like, the number of questions I have is actually ludicrous. Anyway, so would you please, your article's called A Smorgasbord, which I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing correctly. Could you please just outline what was the main kind of thesis of your article?
Sure, there is one.
Good. Okay.
It is a mashup of stuff. It's a mashup of stuff, partly because I'm terribly indecisive. And the Smorgasbord is because I now live in Stockholm, so that's where that came from. But the main thing is that I have learnt a lot through doing the wrong things over the years. So in a way, it's a collection of war stories. It's a collection of, oh my God, that didn't work, let's try it like this. And then eventually you build up this toolkit of ways of approaching things that seems to work and seems to be repeatable. So that article is a collection of, I got it wrong, here's how I now do it, because it kind of works, but I got there by doing it wrong first. So that's what they are. Lessons I don't want other people to have to learn.
It's every rule aboard a ship is a memorial to a dead sailor.
Yes, exactly, but, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So I think, like, the thing that really stands out to me when I read your article, but also just sort of from what I know about you anyway and from kind of listening to your sort of career history, is some writers approach writing from very much kind of, I'm thinking about the words, I'm thinking about the character, I'm thinking about the fictional world, and then I just need to get it out there somewhere. But it seems to me that you're someone who is just inherently fascinated by the technologies that we use to actually tell the interactive story. Not in the limited sense. I'm not suggesting that you're just fascinated by coding, because obviously if you're building LARPs, that's nothing to do with coding. But a LARP is a system for delivering interactivity. A computer program is another system for delivering interactivity. Role-playing games are as well. Would you say that was a fair characterization? Just the thing that's really interesting is, okay, here's this mechanism. How do I make it tell a story?
I think that's fair to say, but I think there's a layer above that, really. And I think the layer above that is, how do I make someone feel a particular way? Whether that's an individual person or whether it's a group of people. And it's reverse engineering from that, actually. It's, how do I make them feel like that? What are the mechanisms I can use to make them feel like that? And in some routes that can take us into game mechanics, in some routes that can take us into looking at how an old school stage magician would have done that thing. In some cases it's emotional deviousness, but it's always, I want the player to feel like that. As a really simple example, it made me think about how stories, I look at them as machines in a certain way, as quite mechanical things in a certain way. As an example, you want somebody to feel like they have been betrayed by another character, in which case you'd better build them up so that earlier on they are absolutely certain that that's their best friend. You know what I mean? You have to push down here and pull up there for the second part of it to land.
Load the spring to fire.
Absolutely. So. And that doesn't mean there's no room for nuance, and there's no room for emotion, but there are things that I have learned over the years that appear to give you, to load the bases to make these things work. And you can push them from all sorts of angles. It could be the music, it could be the casting, it could be a particular choice of word, it could be the colour in the background, it could be almost anything. But you are essentially pushing at the player and to make them, to put them into a certain mental state, to then do something with that mental state, whether it's tricking them or whether it's fulfilling that or whatever it is. And one of the people I go back to repeatedly is Derren Brown, if you come across Derren Brown and his writing partner, Andy Nyman. And some of the stuff that he talks about also goes to people like Hitchcock, for example. There are definitely tricks to play to be able to deliver a gag, I suppose. That doesn't mean that the gag isn't meaningful and deeply rooted in character and story, but I think that mostly when I am designing, I tend to think from that and then think of another one and then think of another one and figure out how they all stitch together. And by the time you've got three gags, you've also got all of the foreshadowing for the gags and all the balancing you need to do, and then the payoffs. And it's not very long before you have this framework of a structure that you can then start to feel the emotional through line for, if that makes sense.
No, I love this. I love this because if you look at them like clockwork machines a little bit, right? Like you will start with sort of one puzzle which has its solution and another one. And if you're also immersed in the world of other types of stories, you will very quickly see that pattern having been repeated in some other place and say, ah, indeed, there is a sort of subgenre around this. And there is a reason that they kind of operate this way or that they use this thing. So if your gags are, say, dramatic ones, then this is the way you do it. I mean, a sort of golden-eared listener might have heard that Ian also works for the Chinese Room, where I too am. So he and I work very, very closely together. And Ian is very used to me delivering overwriting, which he then helps me appreciate that can be done much more efficiently. So, but one thing we don't often get to talk about is how you might be able to do that exact type of thing, that exact type of sort of input output in something you have a deep specialty in, which is LARPing, right? What are some of the lessons that you might be able to share from that world? Because it seems very distinct, right? In some ways, in how you would design those little puzzle moments.
Yeah, I think it's the same fundamental thing, which is trying to make people feel a particular way. A good example, and it depends entirely what we're doing, but say a few years back we did a game for about, I think, 30, 40 people and crew, which was the Three Musketeers. And we were only ever going to run one Three Musketeers event. So you make a list. What are the things that make a classic Three Musketeers experience, adventure? There's the things from the 1970s movies, there's more modern movies, there's D'Artagnan, there's, you know, all of these kind of things. What are the things which would not only make you feel like you're in a musketeer's world, but what would make you feel like a musketeer? What would make you feel like you could do the things that they could do? Well, firstly, it's a movie. It's not a role-playing game. It's not immersive. It is a movie. That means we can do things like cut, play with time, have montages, jump from place to place. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. One example, a lot of what we do is look at how we could fit things into the mechanics, which will make you feel like that without us just telling you a story about it. So a couple of really simple examples of mechanics. There's a masked ball. Well, everybody knows in masked balls in those eras, when somebody wears a mask, they're unrecognizable, right? Completely unrecognizable. You may have known that player and that character for many years, but you won't recognize them because they're wearing a mask. So we introduce a really simple mechanic. If you are wearing a silver mask, you cannot be everybody else in the room wearing a silver mask, you'll be mistaken for. And what's interesting about that is you're separating the player from the character. You're saying to the player, play along with this. People will have more fun. And they just get it. And they play along like that. And they have that gag. And they really enjoy that gag of going to some, Mr. Smith, aren't this? I know it's not Mr. Smith. You know it's not Mr. Smith. But they will play along with the gag. And you get players to be complicit in having fun. Another example is the duel mechanic. If you're a musketeer, you're going to be great at dueling, right? Amazing at dueling. But as players, you're probably not. You're maybe not good at sword fighting. So how do we make you feel good at dueling? Well, what we do is we send the seconds forward first and they have a quick conflab and they come up with the result between them. It could be based on some tokens we've given you, could be based, but they have a quiet conflab and they decide what the result is going to be. And they go back to the two people dueling and you say, by the way, you're going to win. And then it's the other person's job, the person whose job it is to lose, to make that person look good. And so they'll have an epic duel and the person who's going to win the duel will have a brilliant time because the person they're up against is being terribly giving as a player and it's not a combative player moment, right? And we loved it. We thought it was great and we thought we'd covered all sorts of things. But what we didn't count on was players. because at no point did we say you must use swords. Therefore, we had several arm wrestling sessions during that game, which went really well. We had drinking competitions. We had one moment where a Cardinal's Guard member and a member of the Musketeers decided they would have a live grenade off. And our pyrotechnic team gave them each a live grenade and lit it. And the two of them are there with the wicks going, I mean, real wicks going down. This was actual pyrotechnics. And it was who could flinch first would win the duel. And of course, they'd already figured it out behind the scenes. But just these moments of putting, I like to think of that stuff. And the same applies to computer games, of giving people a tool set that they can pick up and experiment with and come up with things that you didn't think of, or come up with things which they don't realize that you thought of, but you left them the material there just because they might make that thing happen, if that makes sense.
So I think that sounds like the greatest thing that has ever been made. So, like, I think LARPing is, for me as a human being, perhaps beyond my my Britishness threshold. I don't know, I've never tried it, but like it sounds challenging. We used to do murder mystery parties when I was a student, and that was good fun. I could do that. That was, you know, a safe environment. I don't know, but it does sound incredible. I think I love the kind of that idea of designing the narrative systems to kind of get the player to be complicit in the creation of a better drama. I think that's fantastic. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting to just bring that back to the context of computer games, because that's really hard to do in this environment we have, where, especially in single player games, where it's just you versus the machine, and people go into a very, I want to master this, I want to beat it, I want to be the operator. In a lot of the stuff that we've done here at Inkle, I've often tried to try and create this sense of, you could do it this way, but it'll be funnier if you do that. So, you know, a lot of 80 Days and our kind of the sorcery games, I always describe them as comedies, because what we're trying to do is give the player a boring choice, which will work in case they're panicking, and then a fun choice, which almost certainly won't, in the hope that eventually they'll go, oh, I just want to press that one and see what happens. And it's interesting that I think the player base often really splits quite heavily into the people who get that and can join that drama and just really have a whale of a time getting wrapped up in rugs and kidnapped in the sorcery game, or driving frog onto a train off the edge of a cliff or whatever. And people who are just totally functional about it. They're just like, well, this is not the efficient choice. I will not do the efficient choice. So I guess my question is, like, what strategies can we employ? What can we do to help players basically out of their comfort zone when they look at that kind of game design and say, this doesn't look like a narrative game, it doesn't look like a game, it's not combative enough? How do we help people out of that comfort zone and into a place where they understand that we're here to make the funnest story possible between us? Like, in a LARP, that makes a lot of sense, because you've got that community vibe, I guess, that's helping to drive that. What can we do in a computer game context?
That's a really interesting question. So I don't have a solid answer for it, but I think for me it comes into a few things. Firstly, there's the experimental nature of things, as you say, and that partly may go into genre. It may be, if I poke this, will it go badly wrong for me? If you look at something like Monkey Island, it was never going to go badly wrong for you if you poked it, because you couldn't die, as opposed to Sierra, for example. But I think there's part of it that's about role-playing here, which is, there are often mechanical choices, but there are role-playing choices, and I'm not necessarily talking about branching dialogue. That is a thing, right? I would never say that, so I'm going to say this. Of these three choices, I'm going to say this thing. But I don't know if you have that experience, but even if you're doing customization, I found this amazing suit of armor that I want to wear. That's incredibly powerful, but it doesn't look as cool and suit the character as the one I've had for, like, ages, and that's the one that is the character for me, so I'll wear that one. And I think extending that out goes, here's the world and the metaphor and the thematic feel of this experience. Here are the choices in front of me, whether they be narrative choices or whether they be go push that button or walk through that door. What feels right? What rings a bell? What kind of jibes as the right thing for me? Because I think we see that in tabletop role playing, and I think we see it in LARP, where everything is aligned, everything almost pushes the story in a certain direction, not in a railroady way, but in a, if I do this thing, it feels right for the story, for the character I'm playing. So that's the thing I'm going to do, and I'll be fulfilling my part of the contract of this thematic resonant thing which I find myself inside. And for me, I think that's one approach.
Just to reflect that back, it's kind of setting up verbs in the game, essentially things the player can do that have particular tonal affordances or thematic affordances.
Yeah.
So, you know, smashy options for the smashy people and cunning options for the cunning people, and then trying to build a world in which those are the options that are available. So it's to draw you into a characterization.
I think so, and I think it is about that characterization. I think the thing which hits me quite hard with those, and I know other people have done this, is that concept, my character would not do that thing. And I know so many people who have taken something which is supposed to have huge amounts of choice, you know, Mass Effect series or something like that, who go and play it through a second time and find that they cannot deviate from the canon character that they've created.
Yeah.
But then the question becomes, do you lock it down into one character, or do you look at the broad spectrum of players that you will have coming to this game? Do you look at the marketing kind of prototypes for those certain types of player and go, have we got something for that type of player? Have we got something for that type of player? Have we got something for that? Have we covered all of those things? So they can have their canonical version of the story that makes it them feel like it's right and that they're properly portraying or pushing forward this character. It doesn't need to be portraying, but pushing them along that story version.
That's definitely something that we've kind of hit the boundaries of. So in a game like Overboard, right, in the Overboard you play the villainess, right, you play the murderer trying to get away with it, and we found that most people approaching that game could get into the vibe of that. For whatever reason, they thought, okay, I understand, yeah, I can think of this as a puzzle, and then I'm going to do some bad stuff that I normally feel bad doing in a game in order to beat this puzzle. We made a sequel called Expelled, which is set in a boarding school. The stakes are somewhat lower. The characterization is a bit broader. And we found that the audience struggled much more with that idea of, I'm going to do the bad thing. I think because of the setting, because people were like, well, I can't do that. That's too mean. And I can't view this quite, either the people are too people-y or the puzzle is not puzzly enough, that people kind of, we had a lot more people with a real sort of, yeah, I'm just going to leave that there because that's the limit of how bad I can be.
That's how I felt in this. Yeah, because they're students or something. So it's like something as innocuous as this that, like, the context of that sort of feels like, can I really be mustache twirly with this and, like, go all out and explore these things? But I had this exact same experience as you're describing it. Like, even specifically with Mass Effect, I was like, I'm going to do an evil run, and I could not do it. I could not do it. Yeah. I was unable entirely to not try to white hat my way through that entire series. And then I was like, well, what's the point of playing this? But of course, if you're in production, you're like, well, then why are we making a game that is this costly, right, to, like, get this wide when we don't have some of the things you've described, which is the things that allow us to nudge it along certain paths or make those things feel inevitable by the truth of that world.
Yeah, I think, and this is by no means wanting to diss Mass Effect, I really, really enjoy the game, but I think part of that is looking at the axes that you're starting with, because the Mass Effect one fundamentally is Paladin or Dick, but they're always good, right? It isn't good or evil, which is the thing that they learned from earlier games that they did for the Knights of the Old Republic. So I guess what are the axes that you're defining the character along?
Right.
Are they all characters who I would enjoy playing, or are they an attempt to make a personality go from being a good guy to a bad guy? Because if you look at the stats on that, and I think BioWare have said that something like 78% of people go for the white hat, and only 25 people complete the bad version, because it just feels wrong, right? It doesn't gel in the same way that John was saying about Expelled. So I wonder if part of it is looking really carefully at the personas that you're trying to give the player permission to do, and then secondly finding a way to give them permission to be bad by giving them examples of being bad in a way which is enjoyable and non damaging, I wonder.
You're punished or something.
I don't know. Bully would be a thing I'd look at for expelled, for example.
Yeah, so, I mean, in expelled we kind of solved that quite head-on in the end. We had a character just literally point out exactly why you had to be bad within this social structure. But I think Mass Effect was always an interesting example for me. Like, I think it's old enough that we can criticise. I think we should be allowed to criticise games that, you know, are not necessarily on the profit-loss boundary anymore. And I think one of the things I found disappointing in the design of Mass Effect when I encountered it was that the bad choices generally had no rationale behind them. Like, it was kind of, well, I could give a coin to this beggar, okay, I might not feel like doing that, or I could shoot him point blank in the head, and I'd be a bit sort of, well, that doesn't really buy me anything either. Whereas if it's more, I always feel like there's a sort of class and a subclass thing going on. Like, my main class is I'm a space hero, right? I need to be a space hero. That's the experience I've signed up for. But what kind of space hero am I? Well, if you watch any 90s sci-fi drama, there's the hitty guy, there's the roguish guy, there's the one who's a liar and a thief with a heart of gold who comes through in the end, you know, and as viewers of those programs, I love those programs. As viewers of those programs, we pick a hero who we're going to track with. We say, oh, I really like this guy. I really like her. And we want to see their arc through the story. And we don't all choose the same person. And that's the ensemble sci-fi drama. And we can sort of build that into a Mass Effect structure. But again, it's I think what you say about choosing the axes is absolutely spot on there.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was talking about personas, as in almost marketing personas. And that almost suggests that which member of this ensemble am I going to be is more interesting, right? Because that, as a replayable thing, if we had, you know, tech time, budget and all the rest of it, to see it from, as you said, the sneaky one's point of view, but you have the other characters in that. And then we're right back to tabletop role-playing. Are you the wizard or the or the scout? And we're into multiplayer games as well. But going back to your original kind of question about how do we make it feel like those? What was your question? How do we make it feel that those choices give us value and aren't just small shades of grey of something that's
or just the choices haven't just been put there for the sake of giving us that
there
choice,
being a choice.
But there is a meaning behind it, or a way forward from choosing that choice, I think.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, I think, in the industry over the last bunch of years, that choices have different meanings in different ways, and that doesn't necessarily mean a mechanical I'm affecting the world. I like role-playing choices. I like choices which are, I'm saying this line because that's how my character would say it. Even if it has no other.
That brings me on to a follow-up question then. How much mechanical backing does this need for a player to engage with it, to enjoy it, to understand it? Like, there are some designers, I'm thinking of the Choice of Games guys, who have been going for years. They absolutely cornered their market. They're great at what they do. But one of their rules is every choice has to have a mechanical impact. And that seems too extreme to me, but where do you stand on that? How do you feel about that stuff?
I'm not sure the word mechanical is the word I'd use there. It may be mechanical behind the... I've written for Choice of Games, by the way.
Of course you have. There's no technology or platform you haven't written for yet. We've established
that. I get bored very easily. That's what it comes down to. The thing which I think is interesting that perhaps I don't see enough of, I see quite a lot of mechanics-based choices which are... mechanically, how does this affect the plot? And I think what's interesting is how does it make other characters in the game feel about me? That may result in a plot consequence, because they feel so bad about you they betray you, or whatever it is, but I'd much rather see, or overhear the gossip, how that affects the social web around you. And we don't have a big white knight meter and evil meter. We have the nuances of interaction between each character that you talk to. Not only directly, but also what have they heard about you because somebody else is complaining about you over there. And I guess that's mechanical, but to me that's much more interesting in a lot of ways than the big, we have chosen to save the world in this way or this way kind of beats. It's what mark am I leaving on this on these people, and the people are the interesting things. The people and the way these people feel and react to you is way more interesting to me as a thing.
I like this. I wonder if we can go actually a little deeper into this. So it's quite relevant you say this, because so many choice of games, honestly, I'd never know how to say this in a sentence. Like how am I, is it a choice of game? Is it a choice of games game? Anyway, are about that, all right? About like the different romance options you have or sort of the community. There's almost always some sort of like mini network. That is not always true. If you are on a more journey-based story, you might be passing through spaces and not really be able to see the consequences. And very often in those cases, we might say, oh, you've affected this faction and their cousins will be upset at you in Act 3 or something, right? But of course, this sense of like being in a space and slowly building a reputation and letting it crumble is an evidence in the work that we've done together and like how we sort of influence one another, and we see this of course in a more Telltale style title or a game like Dispatch, where we're told very explicitly a player is going to remember something, or in our own Bloodlines 2, this character has felt this way about this thing. Is it actually interesting enough just to know that you've made an impact on someone? Because, of course, in reality, every time we say anything, we leave an impact on people. Or does the player need to know that there's going to be some consequence? So in a Telltale-style game, very often they'll indicate this is a particularly big choice that will have a consequence. But many other times they might just say this is being remembered and you might not be able to see it. Like how visible do those things need to be to the player at the time of the choice for it to feel valuable?
That's a big question. It all depends, I think. I like that players get some payback immediately, because then they feel that they've been listened to, and then they realise that there could have been other outcomes there, because otherwise you may feel that you're just on a linear run. You may have no idea that you're on anything but a linear run. Now, whether that needs to be a kind of UI reaction or something like that depends entirely, I think, on the game and the player and how you've explained the game to people, and how they, if they start the game completely understanding that it is an absolute sandbox tool of story, then they're going to assume that kind of thing all the way through. But I think all I can really boil it down to is the world pushes back. Whether it's going to be pushing back in the form of people reacting to what you've done, or whether there is a consequence down the road, it just, you want to feel that the space you've taken up in the world and the actions you've taken in the world are being reflected by the world in some way. And I think we have discovered that an immediate reaction, which could be just a line, could be anything, to a choice that you've made is useful and important. But how comedians build their sets is comedians often deliver a punchline at the end of the show which ties right back to the very beginning of the show. And people think they are terribly, terribly clever, and I'm not dissing comedians because they are terribly, terribly clever. But the weird thing is, the further away you take that world reaction from the point at which you took the choice, the cleverer it feels. So if you chose what your cereal was right at the very beginning of the game, and right at the end of the game, that box of cereal is the thing sitting on the table as you fade out the camera, people are going to go, oh, damn it, they thought about that all the way. And it feels, genuinely, it feels cleverer. Like I say, it's the thing that they do in stand-up shows. It feels cleverer the more distance you put in that reaction. And it can be a tiny reaction, a tiny pushback, and seemingly inconsequential, but people feel that it is their world, the world they defined and the world that they lived in, because the world pushes back. Does that make any sense?
I love that.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. I do think, like,
clarity of design, to just phrasing it that way, I think that I really relate to.
Well, especially because, as you say, I think we've learned as an industry that we might have the most complex, because, like, just talking about choice-based narrative, we might have the most complex, interesting stuff happening under the hood here. But players will assume that they are on rails unless they are somehow told otherwise, or they see it, which is perhaps why, like, at the tabletop or in a LARP, there is a certain affordance given to that, because they know there's the variation of just human acting, right, or of human performance that comes. And so I think that's part of why we've sort of learned this, like, oh, this person will remember this. But it does feel to me to be like quite a heavy-handed way of doing it, right? Like, it does feel like quite heavy to say, this person has remembered this, and otherwise all the other lines you shouldn't pay any attention to because none of them are making any difference, right? So I get the idea of every choice an impact, because then you don't need to do the, hey, they've remembered this, because the assumption is in the medium you're in, there is, it is going to be remembered, it is going to be reflected back. But surely this gets, the problem is, like, in a computer game that isn't just text or isn't primarily text, we get pulled back from that by some other department, I feel. In any sort of larger game, very often you might say, well, making this choice might mean that this faction becomes friendly to you. But your game design colleagues might say, yes, but then we have no action to do in the latter half of the game, and that does not fly. So there needs to be some other enemy that fills in, or that same enemy is still upset at you. And suddenly you get an outcome where you're like, well, yes, as a player, I've had an impact. I've swapped out the color scheme of these people's uniforms, but fundamentally, I'm still playing the same game. And so I wonder if is that a unique problem to sort of computer games, or perhaps like more action-oriented computer games even? Or is this...
I don't think it is. I think it's a function of story generally. If you solve the plot of the story in whatever medium within the first few pages, and you have no conflict for the rest of your story, and not all storytelling needs to be conflict-based at all, but it tends to be crisis-based, or it tends to be pressure-based. And if you've removed all that pressure, then what's the rest of the story about? And I often see that happening in sequels and sequels to movies, for example, where the big bad or whatever it was, the big issue has been dealt with. So what's the second film or the second story? Where are the cracks? And that also comes down to, you know, really careful design of the worlds and things like that, because if you want to tell more than one story in your world, you can't solve the world in the first story, because then you need to throw something at it from a different angle. And what's more interesting is maintaining a balance of fracture lines for that stuff. To sort of dive slightly sideways back into choice, because we talked a lot about narrative, branching style choice. I think a thing which is underused, and I've talked about a little bit, is realizing that the player is making choices all of the time when they're playing. They're making choices about, you know, if it's a combat-based game, what weapons do they use? How do they approach things? Do they sneak? Do they go all out and mash things to pieces? Do they use potions? Do they cast spells? What costume do they wear for this particular character? Is it always all in silver and really bright? And are they therefore telling us that they actually want to be a paladin? That there are behavioural... When I go into a new space, do I charge straight into it? Or do I look around the walls first and then do I take a few steps into it? So we can learn whether they're being... sneaky or spending more time exploring every little thing that you find in the game. Very few games, I think, run metrics on those things and use metrics to affect the story. A lot of them run metrics on them, but they don't often affect the story. Whereas the player is constantly telling us who they are by acting. And I wonder whether we should be listening as much or more to that and having the world push back against that than we are worrying about choices in branching narrative, actually.
I think that's really interesting. Because I think one thing that we struggle with in games, if we go down to that kind of level of granularity of watching what the player is doing, is the gap between what the player is doing in an ideal state and what the player is doing because they are very rarely in an ideal state. So, a lot of players will go into an environment and walk around the edges of it and look for all the dead ends first. Not because that's what the character would do, not because it makes sense in the story, but because they go, oh, I don't know the geography and I need to know the geography before I can play the game. So it's almost like they if there was a metric, if there was a genuine metric, they need a pause button where they can say, pause, this isn't really happening in the story. This is just me casing the area. Okay, now I'm ready for my performance within the environment. And I mean, again, this is something we've kind of played with a little bit in some of our games. In Heaven's Vault, one of the things I really wanted was simple things like, if you don't talk to someone, that's treated as a decision, not as a, oh, I'll come back to it later. The people just don't stand around, and if you don't talk to them, then they'll be grumpy about it later on. And again, we find a really clear split of the people who just are going, oh, I love how responsive this feels, and I feel like it's channeling to my choices, and other people saying, wait, this thing is so fragile because I could just be over here looking at the view and suddenly I've affected the story over there and I wasn't even engaging with the story at that point. So how can you do that to me?
And I kind of respect both points of view, really. But I wonder if there's some way to gather those up. Because what I ideally want as a creative is I want players to be acting. I think that's a beautiful word for it. We talk about role playing, but let's talk about acting. Let's make a game in which we say explicitly to the player, when you walk into this environment, you are visible in the way that you would be if you were on stage, and you need to act appropriately. If you get called up onto a theatre stage in an improv show and they say, put this hat on, you're a cowboy, you're not supposed to go, okay, what do I do next? How do I do this? Can I just check where the edges are? You're supposed to say, yeehaw, boys, which is hard to do.
So, I think that's I think that's really interesting, but I think I offer a partial solution for it.
Go for it. I hadn't even got to the question, but go for it.
And the partial solution is to look at the behaviour that you think is them not acting and figure out what sort of character they would be cast at who would do that behaviour. Are they a master sneak thief? And is the game suddenly about being a master sneak thief? Do you see what I mean? If they go into, as you say, if they go into everything and they case the joint first, then maybe the game is about a master thief and that's the action that they do because it's fine, that's playing the character. Do you see what I mean? I mean, maybe the undesirable behaviour, if you call it undesirable because it doesn't quite fit your story, maybe we should be examining that and writing to it.
You kind of want to gather that back into the fold of story.
Because that's how they want to behave, so yeah. Why not give them a character who would behave like that? Because I think it's quite important to collapse the player and the character for me in a lot of ways.
So one thing I really loved about the old Thief game was I remember it was a game where walking around felt like a characterful thing to do, and that was partly mechanical. It was to do with the way light and shadow and detection worked, but it was also just because the character was clearly kind of cool just to be. So yeah, I think Batman kind of riffed on that idea as well, the Arkham Asylum games, in the same way. But that does limit us to... Does that limit us? I feel like that limits us to cautious players, like investigative players, like... How do we make a game in which a player bursts onto the stage of every level and says, "Hello, I'm here"? Like, how do we encourage the more sort of flamboyant and dramatic side of things?
I think it's about that casting. Well, it's two things. Does it matter that we're making a game for one type of player? I don't think it does, actually. That's the character that we've got on the box that they are playing. But if you do want a range of stuff... we're back almost at the sort of ensemble casting, because are you a sneaky thief type character, or are you Porthos from the Three Musketeers? In which case, I need to have put the idea of Porthos from the Three Musketeers in your head. You need to have seen it on the cover. You need to have gone, when you select your character type, it's Porthos, and he's standing there, and he's doing all the stuff which Porthos would do, and therefore, when you pick him, you know that that's how you're going to act.
And you get a combat buff if you walk into the middle of a room.
Yes.
And you
yes.
start doing stuff.
Well, another mechanic example, we were looking at the Three Musketeers. We had divided them into cadres because it feels better when you're a group of four or five than it is if you're a group of 30. And each group of four or five would have a servant with them, a planché with them. And we went, well, mechanically, how does that make any sense? Well, a couple of things. Firstly, when all the musketeers get knocked down, the only thing that can heal them is Planchet going around and healing them however he wants. It could be giving them a glass of wine. It could be slapping them around the face. It could be whatever. He'll get them back up on their feet again because that's his job. And if you suddenly want to have everybody back to full health, twice a day, you can all clash your swords together and go all for one and one for all, and you'll be up and mechanic. And that means that we have people doing those things that you see on the film because it's a mechanical requirement of play. And so feeding, for me, the Porthos character, if you're having a combat computer game, then you give them bonuses and buffs from acting Porthos-ly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love this because you could... Maybe one way of threading this needle is to have it always be positive. Like, whatever, like, the typical player behaviors are, if it's more like they all give you, they all give you some sort of buff, or they all give you, they all react to it in a way that rewards that type of play. And all that's happened is that you made an opportunity cost of what not to do. Maybe that makes it a little bit better. But also this notion of the ensemble of, like, you are sort of, It's almost like you're suggesting that for some of these types of games, we actually treat the beginning or quite a bit of it as an audition for this. This is almost like the menu of different types of characters we have. You get to see the key players in the sort of formal sense, right? Like the key characters. And maybe you're fundamentally picking which archetype you are going to be. And mechanically, this is already a thing, right? In many RPGs, like you sort of have the tutorial, and then you're asked what your vampire clan is, what your sort of D&D class is, or so on. Because we've learned over all of this time that like people just need time to figure out your unique take, game designer, on this particular feature. But what if that went farther? It wasn't just sort of the class, but you're in fact choosing to inhabit that specific mask, that specific role. I suppose now we're getting to the point where you need a really specific type of story and world where like, all of these things would work. Yeah. But
I think it's a cool idea, and I think we have seen some of that in, for example, the early Dragon Age, where you had all those completely different interactive
origin stories and
things, origin stories and things, which was great. But I think it's worthwhile not forgetting that our game extends beyond the boundaries of the computer. So that by the time you have bought the game, picked it up and decided to play it, you might well have been deluged by the advertising of that particular character type. That particular character type. Look how cool this character type is. So I think there are choices that you can make even before you pick up the box, if it's carefully handled. Or if it's a genre that you know, or if it's based on a film that you know. I think there are archetypes here that you can draw on without having to explicitly play it through.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like you're making a Star Trek game, and it's like, which of the boxes do you buy? Do you buy the Spock box, or do you buy the pick sort of your Uhura box, like whichever one you're getting. That's your kickoff character type, perhaps, right? You can do a partnership with marketing for it. Yeah.
I love it. Well, I feel like we have reached our 45-minute limit, having redesigned the entirety of the Western computer game RPG tradition in less than half an hour with jokes. So let's leave it there. But although there's a mountain of things we could continue to talk about. But the time has really flown by. Thank you so much for joining us, Ian. It's been absolutely brilliant. And listeners, please join us again next week when we will talk to yet another one of our fabulous authors.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.